Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. We are recording this just after the big storm that hit the East Coast in March. Fortunately, we've all survived. We're just a little bit stuck inside our respective homes right now. But we have a great cast for you today. First, Megan has returned to the cast after a few weeks. Please welcome back Game Wisdom contributor and co-host, James Ellerby.
Hi, guys. Sorry for the hiatus.
Not a problem. For folks who've been listening to the Game Wisdom Live, our live shows, James got back on as well, just as we finally figure out how to use Discord to have people come on and chat with us. But, James, how are you doing this fine, very snow-filled day?
Cold. Actually, no. My apartment's actually pretty warm right now, so, and I'm doing pretty good, actually. It's a kind of a, it's a snow day. Haven't had a snow day in a while since being a kid, so it's kind of cool.
Yes. And our guest tonight is returning from Gray Alien Games. Last time he was on, we spoke about casual game design and his upcoming game, Shadowhand. Tonight, we're going to talk more about being in the indie developer business and what it's been like for over a decade. So, please welcome back to the cast, Jake Burkett.
Thanks, Josh, and hi, James. It's a pleasure to be here again.
It is great to have you back on, Jake. For those of you listening to this cast right now, Jake, of course, just got back from GDC this year, and I'm sure you have lots of stories to tell about that.
Yeah, it was a good blast. I mean, it's always quite nice to go just to get away from my – I work at home, so it's good to sort of go there, meet all these indie developers, talk about what's happening in the industry, eat loads of food, you know, and just being in America for me, obviously, is something different. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. For those of you listening to this cast right now, I just had my first little live presentation about – it'll be a few days from this recording, or probably a few weeks from when you're listening to this. And that was a lot of fun to get out there and actually see the people who are listening to me talk for 20, 30 minutes. Or this one was actually for an hour. And I'm hopefully by the time you are listening to this, I'll have more scheduled and more to report. But yeah, GDC was a lot of fun. Like I said, I went out there in 2011, and at some point I really need to get back there and start blabbing to developers about game design for until they eventually get tired and walk away.
Well, I'm sure they won't. One of the best things at GDC is talking game design with other developers. I love it.
Yeah.
And for me, it's good to go multiple years in a row because you start to sort of build up repeat contacts with people, and then you get to know them better and you get to know the lay of the land and where the cool parties are, where the best places to eat are. So, you know, where the best places to stay are, you know, and which places to avoid.
Yeah.
So it's definitely good to keep going.
For people listening to this cast right now, if you miss our last discussion with Jake, we talked about his upcoming game, Shadowhand. And for those people who may just be like tuning into this one, miss the last one, could you quickly go over what Shadowhand is or what it's going to be about when it's released?
Sure. So Shadowhand is an RPG card game. It's actually a prequel to Regency Solitaire, which we made in 2015, that, you know, got some decent press and did pretty well. That game was a sort of romantic themed card game, but this one is about a highway woman in 1770 in England. And she's kind of like Robin Hood figure. She travels around the countryside and she's trying to deal with corruption and blackmail issues and things like this. And but basically what's different from our past game is you use the sort of solitaire style card play in order to drive turn-based combat, which has never been done before. A bit like Puzzle Quest. So it's very much an RPG with the cards sort of in the middle to help drive things along. And we're pretty excited about it. I think it's going to turn out well.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating. And when we spoke about this a few weeks ago, it definitely piqued my interest in terms, again, of combining these different genres and mechanics into something new. And for those of you listening to this cast right now, we're not going to be focusing on Shadowhand tonight, but if you want to give a listen to that, the link to the previous podcast will be in the notes below. I guess just to sort of put a cap on this part, for people listening to this cast who are now interested in Shadowhand, what is, I guess, the current idea for a release date that you have?
Well, that's what my publisher keeps asking me. We're aiming for April sometime. I think it might be towards the end. It really kind of depends how the testing goes and whether I need to sort of tweak things before release. But heck, I'm big time running out of money and we need to release this game. So it's going to be sooner rather than later.
Cool. And like we were saying before the cast, both of us can't wait to check this out. So I'm definitely looking forward to it. And for those of you listening to the cast right now, there is a chance we may have Jake on for a live talk about the game closer to the release. I don't know at this point in time if it will be either before or after this cast, but here's hoping we can get that going, because I'm sure a lot of people will love to chat with us about what the game is.
Yeah, that sounds good. I'm up for that. Probably in April sometime when you can maybe try it out and we can talk about it.
Cool. But let's get to our main topic tonight. And this is one that we were starting to talk about last time you were on, but this will be our main focus for tonight. And that is being an independent developer and basically lasting the long run. As we've talked about multiple times on these casts, our live shows, and with other developers, the act or the challenge of surviving in the independent game scene is one of the many, I guess, quote-unquote mysteries of what it means to be a game developer. As we are all aware of, and I'm sure you folks listening as well, when it comes to talking about the business or basically surviving the game industry, we of course hear about the big name hits. When Stardew Valley, you know, exploded, I think it was last year or the year before that, you know, every major publication talked about it. When Five Nights at Freddy's, you know, all of a sudden took control over YouTube for some time, everyone talked about that and what's going on with it. But when it comes to the people who are in the industry for the long run, the ones, as Jake's presentation talked about, who haven't had that, you know, one-of-a-kind breakout hit game of the year 10 out of 10s that everyone loves, it's a different story. And I definitely want to have you back on, Jake, to talk about your experience and, again, kind of illuminate this side of the game industry, especially for enthusiasts or first-time developers just getting in who have, again, like zero idea what to expect when it comes to being your own boss in this industry. And this is also another reason why I wanted to have James on, because with James has been slowly learning more about the business side, especially since he signed on with Game Wisdom. And I'm sure he will have a lot of questions as well as someone who's been coming at this more from the consumer point of view.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's kind of interesting in the fact that, like, it reminds me a lot of the acting world, which I'm somewhat acquainted with. And the fact that, like, you always hear about the Tom Cruises, and you hear about the the Tom Cruises, the Will Smiths, all of these the big name actors. But like, what actually really makes the acting world function as a whole is the minor stuff, is the actors that are doing commercials consistently, the actors that are doing minor TV shows, you know, the stuff that, you know, like a lot of people think that if you're not Tom Cruise, then you're not acting. And that's not true at all. And I think the same really works in the gaming industry. And I'm really eager to see how it works in the gaming industry from that point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess to get things started, for people listening to this cast right now, Jake, how long – I think we mentioned this last time, but just to reiterate, how long have you been working as an independent developer with Gray Alien Games?
Okay, well, I say 12 years sort of full time, okay? I mean, I was a hobbyist developer for 21 years. These days, if you're a hobbyist, you know, you can call yourself indie. Some people do. Mm-hmm. But I think of it as when I said to my wife, and it was actually the summer of 2005, yeah. And I said to her, hey, I want to quit, you know, my job making business software and make games for a living. And, you know, we obviously had to have a discussion about that because, you know, we had two kids, just had a second son, and we've got a mortgage and bills to pay. And I was like, yeah, I want to do this thing. But she was supportive. And you know, I went and did this thing. And I'm still here 12 years later in one form or another.
Mm-hmm. And for, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, with Gray Alien Games, of course, the recent game that probably most people know you about is Regency Solitaire, and fingers crossed that we'll be hearing more from Shadowhand in terms of accolades. But before Regency Solitaire, what were some of the other games that you developed?
Okay, I've made about 10 plus games. It's hard to kind of keep track. Mm-hmm. Commercial games, that is. I've also made a lot of free games because I like to do game jams and stuff to hone mm-hmm. my skills and just have fun. In 2007, I made a game called Fairway Solitaire as a contractor for Big Fish Games. And at the mm-hmm. time, that was very well known in the casual download space. So that one did well. I did a whole bunch of sort of match three games with seasonal themes. And one of them I did was called Spooky Bonus, which is about Halloween and decorating your house. Mm-hmm. And that one was released in 2013. And that did very well indeed in the casual game space. Mm-hmm. Most people who are into indie games or mainstream games probably won't have heard of it, but it did sell mm-hmm. 50,000 copies in the casual space. So there's plenty of people have played it, just not maybe Steam gamers, mm-hmm. if you see what I mean.
Yeah. And for those of you listening to the cast, we kind of had that discussion last time as well about sort of like the difference between the casual and the Steam markets and how that has impacted your decisions or your business decision when it came to releasing your games. I remember when we last spoke that you mentioned that if you just focused on Steam with your titles, you probably will have gone bankrupt years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was really more about branching out outside of Steam that has kept things going.
Yeah, for sure. Because what I figured out, there was a bit like a formula for casual games. If you knew mm-hmm. that, you know, if you picked a genre that you could achieve as a smaller team and with a smaller budget, you could basically make a game within that genre. And as long as it was quite good, you could sort of put X money in, pull a lever, and Y money would come out. And that was quite appealing as a family man and someone who wanted to stay in business. So I kept sort of putting that money in, pulling the lever out, and moving forwards. Whereas, you know, if I'd put those casual games on Steam only, there just wouldn't have been enough of a casual audience on Steam to survive. So, yeah, I had to sell them off Steam in places like Big Fish Games, iWin, Game House, Shockwave. There's quite a lot of sites doing that sort of game.
Yeah. I guess that's kind of like the first, I'm not sure this would be considered a myth, or one of like the first big things that people hear about when it comes to being a developer or an indie developer today is that for a lot of people, they feel that Steam is it is the de facto king of the hill. You're either on Steam or your game fails. And as we talked about last time, especially with the upcoming changes with Steam Direct, that being on Steam may not be a guarantee for a lot of people anymore. So I guess for you, Jake, in terms of doing Grey Alien games for 12 years and being in both the casual and Steam market, how have you, putting your game out there, like for people listening to this cast who may be working on their first game and are just unsure of what to do if Steam is not an option, do you have any advice on that front?
Let me have a think. Actually, I want to put a sort of caveat before everything I say tonight, because when I was at GDC, there was an interesting panel with various people on it, and they talked about how advice changes. So, you know, how they offered advice 5 years ago that now they look back upon and say, actually, maybe that wasn't such good advice, because advice is very specific to the giver and at that point in time. So I may offer some advice now, which may not apply to people in a year or two or even now if their situation is different. But anyway, I can offer things and people can take them or leave them as they see fit. So that's my caveat. That's to keep the lawyers off my back when people say, I followed your advice and burned my entire mortgage on a game. And, you know, and now I don't even have a cat left, you know. So where were we? Right. So what would I advise to people starting out? Well, it really depends, of course, if they're doing something as a hobby or trying to do it commercially. Now, you know, I would definitely advise to practice making games as a hobby first. Absolutely make small free games so that you can practice the skill of making a game. But it's not just, you know, making a game. It's actually finishing a game that's the hard part, because for years and years I used to make small mini games, but I never quite finished them. You know, I'd just move on to the next idea. But basically, once I started to try and finish a game that was good enough quality, I could put it out online for free. And there's places like itch.io. You can put free games. Mm-hmm. You can put them on your own website if you have one. Obviously, if you make Flash games, you can put them on Kongregate and so on. So it's getting practice to putting out free games. And when you think you've got that sorted, and you can obviously do that while you've got a job and you've got an income or whatever, or you're living at your parents, you know, whatever that may be, you've got stability, then you can try your hand at commercial games if that's the route you want to go down. But one must bear in mind that when you turn a hobby into something commercial, the pressures change, and that can affect people's passion as well, a lot. So, and also you may not be able to make the exact game you used to want to make as a hobbyist. You may have to modify your ideas to fit the marketplace, whether that marketplace be casual games or Steam or consoles or mobile. But one big mistake, we keep hearing it over and over, established developers, is people who have spent too much money and too many years on their first game, and then it comes out and flops, and they're in dire trouble. You know, there's a huge amount of advice out there saying, don't do that. You know, spend a small amount on your first game, test the waters, because as with finishing a free game teaches you about the process, finishing a commercial game and attempting to sell it is a very, very difficult process. And you need to do that and see what went right and what didn't go right. And a hint, probably most of it won't go right. Then you can then build upon that for your second game, your third game, and so on. And that's essentially what I did, was made small games, building up my skill, building up my contacts, building up my knowledge until I could gradually spend longer on games. And Shadow Hand's a two-year game now, which for me is a very long time. But for some indies, it isn't very long. You know, I think Owlboy took 10 years or something, for example. So, I mean, I guess I don't know if that answers your question, but hopefully it does.
Yeah, I think it is a good start. I guess as a tangent or an aside right now, is Shockwave still like a big name? Because I remember like looking at their games way back in the early thousands.
Yeah, I remember Shockwave too, yeah.
But it's been a very long time since I've heard or kept track of what's going on there.
They are still a viable portal in a sense. I mean, they actually do sell some of my download games as well. They used to just be online Flash stuff, but they do, yeah, they still make me money every month, and I'm grateful they exist. I don't know how well they're doing in the scheme of things compared to Kongregate or Miniclip or something, but...
All right. Now, I think one point that you just said, Jay, that I want to touch on is about having to adjust your expectations or adjust your design as someone going from hobbyist to, you know, hopefully a business maker or a game designer. Because that, I think, is another one of those big points that a lot of people, especially those who are students or enthusiasts, tend to mess up on. Because as you said, Jake, there is a lot that goes into making a game with the intent to sell. It's not just you sitting at your computer building levels all day. You have to do marketing. You have to understand that people, not just your friends and family, are going to be looking at your game and tearing it apart. And this is a topic we have talked about multiple times on these casts, but it goes back to that, to what a lot of people feel are those two polarizing attitudes, the quote-unquote businessman versus the artist. For many people, especially those who are first-timers or in college or trying to get into the game industry, they tend to view things strictly from the art side.
Yep.
They don't care about the business. They see it as, you know, quote-unquote selling out to the man kind of thing. But I'm sure, as you can attest, you really need to wear both hats if you want to succeed in this industry.
Yeah, big time. So, I 100% agree. I think that you don't need to sell out, and you don't need to be the sort of callous, you know, businessman. You can do both things. If you, the thing is you might have 100 crazy game ideas. I've got loads. I've got more than that, right, sitting in a document somewhere. And you have to pick the ones that you think are commercially viable, that you would still have fun and be passionate about making. Years ago, in 2008, I went to a conference in Amsterdam, a casual game conference, and there was a talk called Passion versus Profit, okay? And it was about game studios which either just tried to make a game from a passionate point of view, whatever they wanted, versus just sort of a hard-nosed business decision. And when they picked either extreme, games tended to fail because the business, pure business ones lacked character, lacked kind of art, obviously, you know. And so the ones that seemed to succeed were the Venn diagram crossed over where people were passionate about it. And that's what I've been doing with my games. So and it seems to be working.
Yeah, and I think that is definitely the smart attitude to take. When we spoke with Z from the studio Serenity Forge, I think it was a few months ago, I asked him about, like, when he started in the industry, like, he has a business background, getting into the game industry, and then he sort of built up his game design side. And I talked to him about those two kinds of attitudes, again, the businessman versus the artist. And he said something that was just really on point. And it was that for him, he finds that there's art in the business just as there is business in the art. And I think that's just a really good attitude to have. And as you said, Jake, I would agree about that, that both that either extreme doesn't lead to, I think, amazing games or specifically amazing games that can sell. As you said, if you go 100% business, you end up with something that's very derivative, something that we've either all seen before, or it's nothing that stands out. On the other hand, if you go for something that's 100% artistic, you may have something that's unique, but it may not be something that anyone will enjoy playing, or there'll be no real amenities or concessions to people who aren't just yourself. So you'll end up with something that maybe you'll like it and your friends will like it, but when you put this on Steam or wherever, everyone's going to be like, I can't play this game. You know, what the hell am I looking at?
Yeah, and there's an aside there, which is that some people do make games which are very popular with the press and even with the indie awards. Don't forget, indie awards are often judged by other indie developers. So you may make a game that's kind of arty and cool and loads of designers and indies love it and the press wax lyrical about it. But when it's put in front of the mass public, they're just like, yeah, meh, whatever. It's not my scene. I don't want to play it. And that can pan out quite often. So I think it's very important that people are clear and honest with themselves about, am I trying to run a business here and survive so that I can keep making games, which is what I'm doing, or am I trying to make pieces of art and, you know, expand the medium and so on, in which case, fine. But, you know, have realistic expectations about how you're going to make money from that. Maybe you need to get funding. Maybe you need to have money from another source that's not even game related so you can pursue your art. So that's it, being clear about what your aim is.
Yeah, and we can certainly see the same thing with TV and film as well, with movies that are critical successes, but, you know, barely made a dent in box office. You know, the quote-unquote niche movies or the I forget the exact term for it. James,
yeah, no, I do know what you're talking about, but I'm trying to think of the term as well. Like the cult classics. And Donnie Darko really didn't sell all that well, you know, in the box offices, but now it's like, you know, it has that cult following to it. But one of my questions that I kind of have for you, though, is do you find that, especially when you're an industry that hasn't had a hit yet, do you find yourself leaning towards, well, maybe we should engineer this game towards a specific audience or towards a specific, like you even talked about, like towards the indie crowd or towards the mainstream crowd or towards the niche group? Like, do you find yourself or your group leaning a game or like your next game towards a specific audience to help it gain more notoriety?
Yeah, definitely. The thing with the casual games was that there was kind of a ceiling limit on how many you could sell within that market and therefore how much money you would get. So even if you had a hit in that market, and I had a couple of games that you could call a sort of minor hit in that market, they didn't make me rich, you know, and I wasn't standing up at GDC going, yay, listen to me. Because of that. But with Shadowhand, you know, we have definitely made that decision that it's an RPG card game. It needs a darker theme. It's going to have complexity and depth and strategy. So, you know, we did plan carefully at the beginning what kind of audience we wanted and, you know, built a game around that, but also around our own passions, which is British history and everything else. And, you know, I really think the thing is these days to stand out, you have to have a game that's pretty interesting and unique and got some kind of hook about it. Otherwise, it's just another puzzle platformer, just another FPS, just another indie game, right? And so right before you even start, you've got to come up with an idea that you test on a lot of people, you know, not just designers, but you've got to find some way to find out, is this a sort of game that has a wide enough audience that I can survive and keep going? Mm-hmm. And part of that, I think, also is making games which people will want to stream as well, mm-hmm. And that can go viral naturally, rather than you having to pump loads of money and time into marketing. You should probably do that as well. Yeah. But if the game can go viral on its own terms, you know, it's marketing itself. So that's not easy, of course, in any shape, form, or fashion, but it's the way forward in terms of indies.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. And as we've talked about with Steam Direct, that is probably going to become more and more important. Bless you, whoever's sneezing. I think. But that's going to become more and more important if Steam is no longer going to be this sure thing for a lot of developers. And again, for those of you listening to this cast, especially if you are listening to this in the future, Steam Direct at this moment is the change that Valve is doing to require developers to pay a fee per game to put their title on Steam, as opposed to the greenlight process where people voted on it. At this point in time, we still don't know what the exact fee will be, but estimates are ranging from $100 per game to $5,000. But again, this is still up in the air, and it may be different from when you're listening to this cast. But as we've certainly seen over the last few years, I think we talked about this last time, there is a lot that goes into having a successful game beyond just making a unique, interesting title. As you just said, Jake, it's about making a game that people are going to be interested in streaming. People are going to be interested in talking about. And that kind of marketing side, going again back to the businessman versus the artist, is one of the things that I've seen a lot of indie developers just struggle with, either in terms of mm-hmm. getting the word out, not having a proper website, and again, just doing simple PR-related things so that people know just what the hell they're actually making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was lucky actually for many years, because when I made casual download games, actually all I had to do was, as long as I made the right type of game, I would send it mm-hmm. to them. And if they liked it and accepted it, they would put it on their website and then drive traffic to it themselves mm-hmm. Because they've got mailing lists and a sort of captive audience. So I didn't really need to do any marketing for that, which was very, very lucky. But for the last couple of games, Regency, Solitaire, and Shadowhand, that is obviously a thing. But for Shadowhand, I'm working with a publisher, Positech mm-hmm. Games, which is really Cliff Harris, Cliff Ski, as he's known on Twitter. And he hired a PR firm in the early days to do some stuff, and that kind of worked out quite well. And, you know, he's got a sort of name as well behind him, and he's going to do advertising and marketing when it ships. So that's another thing indies can do. They don't have to go it alone. They can attempt to team up with a decent publisher that's not going to take them for a ride, and one that lets them keep their own IP and stuff like that. Maybe one that gives them some money to help finish the game. Most publishers won't take your game unless you've got something to show them at the beginning. They're not going to throw $100,000 at you just because you've got an idea. You've got to have a team and some kind of vertical slice. But, you know, that's the other option, is teaming up with somebody who already knows what they're doing to help you get your game out there, and doing it all the way throughout the process, not just at the end, mm-hmm. you know. So,
yeah, definitely. Mm. And another part of this I wanted to talk about, and this I think goes back to what James was saying a few minutes ago regarding trying to steer or tilt your game towards a specific market or a specific group. One of the other things that we've seen, especially in the independent scene, are developers who try to go big with their titles. You know, they've had a decent success or a good one, and then they want to roll the dice or pull the slot machine on something big and attempt to get themselves to stand out. And we have seen many examples of this over the last decade. Two recent ones would be something like Trine, the 2D puzzle platformer, that the third game, they try to go all in with a brand new 3D engine that it almost bankrupted them because they cut out a lot of stuff people were excited about. And then one of the games that I was really excited about was Clockwork Empires, which Gaslamp Games originally made the roguelike Dungeons of Dreadmore. And then,
yep, I know those guys, yeah, from Vancouver.
And then they decided to go, you know, all in with this crazy idea that they had no idea what they were doing. And from reports and impressions right now, it seems like the studio is dead. The game basically just killed the studio. And I guess for you, Jake, like again, with Grey Alien Games, you've not had that massive hit. You haven't gone for the, you know, all in on a single design. When you hear about these stories, and especially as someone who's been designing and running their own business, what do you think about that kind of, you know, over-the-top strategy that some developers have tried to do?
Well, I mean, I find it worrying because, you know, when we hear about talks given by developers that have had a massive hit, you know, often they're going, I've had a gigantic hit, I threw everything into this, you know, I mortgaged my house, everything, and we made a really huge big game for 5 years and look, it went fantastically and we made all this money. You know, you'll hear that talk, but you won't hear the 99 or maybe 999 other people that did the same and it didn't work for them. And so, you know, it's very worrying that that people might sort of see that and think, oh, I need to do the same. For me, even if Shadowhand makes a lot of money, oh, I really wish it does. But if it does, I will not be spending it all on Shadowhand 2. We'll be spending a portion of it in an appropriate amount that if it fails, we've still got more money to roll the dice again. And one person who's very good at this is Cliff Harris, the publisher. He made Democracy 3, Gratuitous Tank Battles and so on. Now, Democracy 3 did make him a lot of money, but what he's done is continue to make small bets afterwards, including publishing Big Pharma, and Big Pharma did very well for him and Tim Wicksteed, the developer. And, you know, I hope that Shadowhand does well for him. It is for him a relatively small bet, even though it's my biggest game. And if it doesn't do well, he gets to roll the dice again because he didn't put all of his eggs in one basket, you know. And I think that's vital for any business, not to put all your eggs in one basket unless somehow you were so sure it could make a return. And who is ever that sure? Nobody.
And like as you said, Jake, there are stories of people who have, you know, done, you know, they have put everything into it and they've had that happy story and there will continue. But as you said, for the other, you know, dozens if not hundreds of people who do the same thing, they're out of the house. Like what we heard about with something like Stardew Valley and how he did the whole game himself for, I think, like 4 years. I mean, it ended happily, but what if it didn't? What if no one wanted Stardew Valley? Like how much of an investment did he really put into that, that if he wasn't going to recoup that, would he be out of his whole house?
Yeah, he's an outlier, and we can't really use them as a measuring stick. I did hear years ago, this is one example, 4 or 5 years ago, I'm not sure now, a developer came out with the game and they said, oh, that they'd asked their friends and family for help. And I think they were $200,000 or $370,000 down, right, at launch. And then the game flopped and they made about a tenth of that back. So like, who do they owe money to now? You know, what's the state of their mortgage? That's really not a healthy state to be in. So yeah, but you know, you do hear the other side. John Blow spent 7 years making The Witness. He was already pretty well known from Braid on Xbox and then other platforms. And you know, The Witness has done pretty well. And I think that's a lot due to his sort of superstar name with the indie space. But, you know, it could have gone south if the game wasn't good. But luckily it did. It was good and it worked out for him.
And I think a lot of new developers or first-time ones have trouble understanding just how important clout is when it comes to marketing and selling your game. Like, as you just said, Jake, whatever Jonathan Blow decides to do next, you know people are going to be talking about it. The same with Scott Cawthorn or I keep forgetting the name of the developer from Stardew Valley. But once you've had that hit and you've become established, you're not really being talked about in the same circles as that little guy who's, you know, like a 2 or 3 man team putting out smaller games. And
Eric Barron.
Eric Barron, is he the Stardew Valley guy? Okay.
Yep, Stardew Valley.
And that's kind of the big point there, is that once you become established, it's kind of like that self-fulfilling prophecy. If you want your game to become big, you have to have a big name. But in order to have a big name, you have to have a big game. And, for too often, people again think that, oh, I'm just going to spend the next 3 years, you know, so much money into this game. I'll be, you know, the next Shigeru Miyamoto, Warren Spector, or Jonathan Blow, and then I'll live on Easy Street. And too often or not, that doesn't happen. And for a lot of developers, they may have a success. It could, you know, be a decent game, but it's not going to be the 3 million copy bestseller that they just mortgaged their, or got a second mortgage on their house trying to build.
And related to that, I was talking to somebody about how, because games are sort of becoming easier to make due to Unity and other engines, and, you know, being able to get them online and ship them and so on. And there are also being game design schools out there where people learn this stuff. And then so making games is almost going the way of being a musician or being an author, where sort of like anyone can do that now. And therefore, to stand out is getting harder and harder. And I think what may happen is that the only people that will stand out will be, A, people who have already made hits, who the press know about, who are the go-to people to get quotes or news from. So they'll go back to those people always and say, what are you working on now? And they'll get some nice free press, right? Whereas they won't ask the sort of first-timers. And the only other people that would do well is people who genuinely make something so astonishing and so good that everyone just talks about it and they make a hit. But there would be this huge raft in between of people that just, you know, make a game and fizzle out, or who continue to struggle. So my tactic longer term has to be, you know, make a good impression with Shadowhand and keep building upon that so that you build a following and reputation. And the press comes to you and customers look for your next game and so on. So that's part of it, definitely building that up.
Go ahead, James.
I was just going to say that it's almost like a scaling from, you know, a scaling of variables that can turn either way, where you have the starting indie person who's unknown, the kid that just makes the game. And, you know, you have a one in how many chance that thing is going to be the next big hit that everybody's talking about. But you start altering those numbers of success by things like, you know, how much clout your name has, you know what I mean? Like what you've done before, how long you've been in the industry, how many people can you get, you know, things like Kickstarter, I think also alter that clout too. You know what I mean? Like how, you know, you might be the kid that just say, there's a game I want to make, and you find a whole bunch of people that are like, oh my God, I want to see that game made. Now you've altered that success to failure ratio even more in your favor, you know what I mean? As opposed to, you know, and that I think a lot of people also forget that success to that success to failure ratio is also the failure part of it is still prevalent in those people that have big names. I mean, like Mighty Number 9 is a phenomenal example of what can happen if somebody with a big name and big clout and who's been in the, you know, they have the time in the industry, they have the big name, they have the pull from the fans, they have, you know, they have the clout of who they are and who they've worked for, and they still fail. You know what I mean? So it's all about, you know, that ratio for failure is still there. It's always going to be there. Now, it may be higher because you're a kid with no name, but it doesn't necessarily mean just because you can become big that ratio that the option for failure has just disappeared.
It's still looming always, always the chance to sort of fail. But that's why if you're cautious with how much you spend so that you can have another chance, you know, then the chance goes down. And also one other thing, you gave some great examples then of how you can affect that ratio in your favor. There are some things which aren't visible to the public, which is what contacts you have. So it's all about networking, as in any business. So if you have the right contacts within the indie industry, you know, you can get advice and help from friends. You can talk to publishers and get funding. You know, is a publisher going to fund you if you've made 10 games before and can show them a prototype, or some kid who's never made a game before? You know, it's pretty obvious, right? So and then, you know, press contacts as well. And even things like if you are a judge for a well-known indie prize, and you have a choice of game A, which you've never heard of, or game B by the third game by John Blow. Which one are you going to play? You know, maybe you'll play both. They're not obligated to. But you play that one, and then, you know, so it has a sort of, you know, cumulative effect where you then can win prizes, maybe just because people play your game, you know, and others fall to the wayside. So there's a whole load of stuff that's behind the scenes, which is all to do with networking and being around for a while, that just grows like interest in a bank, you know?
Yeah. And I think this goes back to what you're just saying, regarding trying to build yourself, like, on this like progressively growing scale, trying to hedge the bet between success and failure. And one of the things that we've seen, especially in this industry, is, and this goes back to what we were talking about with Jonathan Blow and Big Names, is that success breeds success. You're not just going to show up one day, throw a random game out there, and it'll be game of the year, 10 out of 10, you know, bestseller. There, as you said, there's a lot of work that goes both behind the scenes and from the camera when it comes to getting your game out there. We've talked about the idea of marketing, good PR, being able to successfully manage how your game is designed, avoiding, again, spending 5-6 years working on your first game, thinking that this will be the billion-dollar seller that you will that will recoup all your losses. And one of the things that we've seen, especially from a lot of developers these days that have been successful, is that they really have refined the whole process from beginning to end. Like, an example that I've talked about multiple times would be Red Hook Games with The Darkest Dungeon. They didn't just show up one day with The Darkest Dungeon and said, here we are, this is our game. They did months of planning. They did, I think, 6 months to a year preparing for the Kickstarter. They had this whole campaign. They were on YouTube. They were making videos, art, postings, all that. They were transparent with their fans. I mean, they just were one like the poster childs for how do you handle the whole process from beginning to end. And it worked for them. Darkest Dungeon won numerous Game of the Year awards. I think this was either my number one or number two game of 2016. And as we've talked about, when they announce their next game, it doesn't even matter if it is still like a brutal Lovecraftian roguelike. It could be a raising bunnies in on a farm somewhere. Yeah. People are going to take notice of that. And as
people will pay attention, although they need to admittedly probably stick to some kind of similarity. I mean, there's one thing going back to them. I know the Darkest Dungeon team personally. They actually tested Shadowhand for me at GDC, and we swapped design, you know, tips on that. So, one of the things that helped is Tyler Sigmund, the designer. He'd been in the industry for years, and he made a game called Horde back in the day, and other games before this. So again, it wasn't even though they did everything right, it still wasn't even an overnight success, because they had all this previous experience. And Chris Barassa, the art director, fabulous art, you know, very experienced guy. So all of those came together into the perfect storm, but I think it was a long time brewing, if that makes sense.
And again, it's not something like, this is the thing about game development, is that this is not something that happens overnight. You're not going to wake up one morning and think, I have the greatest idea ever, and then by the next day, it's done and it's making millions of dollars. This is an industry where, as you said, it takes a lot of work. And a lot of what goes into success, most people, especially on the consumer side, will never ever see. They'll just see Darkest Dungeon on Steam one day, you know, Game of the Year accolades attached to it, a whole lot of positive reviews on Steam. And they'll be like, oh, well, that's amazing. But they would never know about the Kickstarter or the work done beforehand and everything that led up to that point.
And also the pain of making a game, because not to sound too indie, but when you make a game and it takes a year or two, or Christ, 5 years or whatever, you know, you have to maintain motivation throughout that time period. And that is very tough. It's tough enough for sort of normally balanced people, but a lot of creatives, a lot of creatives are, you know, atypical in their sort of mental approach, you know, have ups and downs, shall we say. And meanwhile, in that time period, anything can happen. Like, you know, you could be bereaved, lose a family member, you could have a kid, you could get an injury, an illness, anything can happen in that time period that can really badly throw you off track. You could be kicked out of your house, you know, anything, right? Mm-hmm. Get divorced, all of this stuff. And somehow you've got to push through and make this game as good as you can and get it out the door. So there's a lot of obstacles in the way which really aren't obvious to the end purchaser.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And like you said, Jake, like any one of these things could be that killing blow to your title. And another part about being an independent developer is that most likely you're not going to be having outside funds coming unless you work a part-time or a second job. You know, in a AAA market, you have the publisher providing you with funding throughout the development process. But again, if you're spending 4, 5, 6 years on a single game, you have to ask yourself, how am I going to have that? Where is that money going to come from during that time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it actually, when I lived in Vancouver, a good friend of mine, I chatted to him about his overheads per month because he was living in a fairly modest flat. It was just him, no kids, no partner at the time and so on. And he wasn't a big spender. Mm-hmm. He was very frugal. I had to persuade him to go in out for a coffee with me or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, but when he told me his overheads, I realized that mine were four times as high, mm-hmm. four times. And it wasn't because I was constantly buying expensive handbags or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was because I had a family. Yeah. We had to have a bigger house. We had a car, you know, whatever, food. It all adds up. Mm-hmm. And that meant that I had to construct games which were guaranteed to earn four times as much money in as his sort of base level. So he could actually afford to sort of – he had a job before in the financial industry and had saved up quite a lot of money, and it was lasting him a long time. So I think that some people can survive a long time if they've got very low overheads and have got some savings. But, you know, if you haven't got those two things, then you need to make something very quickly and test the water and then, you know – move on from there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, definitely. And as we've said multiple times over this cast, it's better, and this is, like, I think, a common opinion from a lot of developers, it's better to fail small. You know, try that crazy idea out, and if it fails, you only spend like a month or two, or let's say 6 months on it. It's better to fail with something like that than fail in a game that you just spend 2-3 years, an entire Kickstarter, and all that on, and that all come crashing down on you.
Mm. All games take longer than you think, all of them. Even the quick ones, you know. Shadowhand was going to be, what, a 6-month project. Then when we showed it at some shows in the UK, people responded well to it, and we said, let's increase the scope, make it about 9 months. But unfortunately, the way I increased the scope and various problems with like the art that needed a lot of editing and tweaking and so on have really ballooned the project out. And I've made 10 games and I thought I knew what I was doing here, you know, and it's taken over twice as long as the original plan. And that's very common. Mm-hmm. Luckily, though, my first two games, it depends how you view it, but luckily they failed quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, I spent 3 months on each of them. They both failed, but I learned something from each one. And those games enabled me to get a sort of work with a producer who came up with an idea and funded a third game. And then I used that to make my fourth. And then I got hired as a contractor for my fifth and so on. So it all kind of rolled forwards. But if I'd spent years at the beginning, it could have been a disaster. It was much better for me just to get stuff out the door, see how that worked and see what I did wrong. Like I realized, oh, games with crappy art don't sell. Now, am I that? No, that might sound obvious, but in 2005, it wasn't obvious, you know, and I made some crappy looking games and realized that's not what people want. They only want to spend money on games that look decent. And I know you can pick outliers. You might pick Dwarf Fortress or something, right? But most games have to look decent to sell. Whether or not they play decent is another thing, but it's your window dressing, right? It's what people get people to look at the screenshots and the video and so on. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. And like with that, like with trying to keep building your game up, a really good example of that, like right now, would be the game Cuphead, which has been another game that I've been really anticipating. The game was announced, I think it was like 2 years ago. It was just going to be like a boss rush kind of thing. Fight, you know, just keep fighting the bosses, beat them all to win. And then after the critical reception came, they said, oh, well, let's expand it here. And after that, it became, oh, now let's have actual levels in our game. And again, that scope just keeps going and going and going. And the game, I think, was originally supposed to be out in early 2016. Right now, it's been pushed to mid-2017. And there are people who are wondering, you know, just what the heck is going on with that game. And as we're seeing, like, especially in these cases, it's very easy for that small idea with the right push or the right motivation to, you know, transform into that big all or nothing for that studio.
Yeah, it's pretty tough. I mean, don't spend a long time on your game. That's all my advice is. Some people would disagree who've had success making bigger games, but then I don't know. It's not for me. It's too much risk. Too much. You know, this game has taken Shadowhand has taken sort of too long, but then it is a hell of a lot better for it. But it's whether there's a point of diminishing returns. You know, are we just sort of polishing away on something which we could have released a year ago. I don't know.
With Owlboy, as we mentioned earlier in this cast, as we said, the game has been in development for 10 years. And I played it and I reviewed it for the site and such, I think earlier, I think it was like late 2016. And after playing that, I just did not, unfortunately, I didn't see 10 years worth of development in this game. It was an okay game, but again, like when we start talking about, when we start talking about these multi-year game development cycles, there's something catching. As we said with something like Braid or The Witness, these are games that you really don't see anywhere else. Or even like The Darkest Dungeon, which was in development for a few years. That's, again, something that you can really see something unique there. But when I played Owlboy, there just wasn't anything that I was seeing that it didn't look like something that took 10 years to be made. And
I haven't tried it myself yet, but I saw them do a talk at GDC that was quite interesting. And I think this may give you an insight there. A lot of the time was obviously spent on the content, creating the artwork. Pixel art is very time consuming, but they did throw away a lot of stuff, or they made a lot of stuff that they didn't use. So they made whole areas and whole sort of worlds and things that literally did not make it into the final game. Now that is part of game design, actually, to be honest. It is throwing out things that, that don't fit or whatever, but I think they spent quite a lot of time on that. And then, you know, you never know at what pace people work, whether they're crunching or whether they have time off, or you know, family things can happen and so on. But that was definitely a thing. It's a content-heavy game, and they threw a lot of the content away, and that is going to be time-consuming.
And I mean, we saw the same thing with like something along the lines of Duke Nukem Forever, that in the span of time it took them to develop that game, they could have released like two or three smaller games in that same span of time. And again, like,
and the end result was horrible.
I mean, one of these days, I should just I should just do a video on it, just for showing it off. You know, examine like the train wreck kind of thing. But as you said, Jake, another major part of games is knowing when to cut something out, and that is something that we have certainly seen in a lot of games. Again, it is better to have 5 hours that are amazing versus a 20-hour game that people get bored of 3 hours in. And there is a very great amount of art and skill that goes into knowing just when is it time to, you know, destroy your baby in a matter of sense.
Yeah, yeah. We've even had to have that thought on Shadowhand recently. There are a few chapters we're deciding, should we do them as DLC? You know, they don't necessarily need to be part of the main plot. So we're having that sort of decision. And the other aspect is, We did have slightly more puzzle levels planned than combat levels, but based on the sort of feedback of the beta and so on, I think we're going to reduce the puzzle levels to be roughly equal with the fights, which will make for a slightly shorter game, but it should be sort of a bit more action-packed and exciting. So that's one of the things we have to do. And I don't know if it was last time, I think it was Dan Cook or somebody said that they would make 300 levels for the game and throw away 200, for example. Which, you know, sounds excessive, but it's like those 100 you left with, they're damn good,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And it's the same thing when I spoke with Chris Park from Arkane Games. When, like, with their titles, they have made some very complex games, from Skyward Collapse, of course, AI Wars, The Last Federation, and so on. And one of the challenges of those games is knowing what to keep and what is just considered ancillary to the experience. And we've talked about this multiple times on the podcast with finding the core foundation or figuring out the core foundation of your game.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And one thing you might find interesting, again, I go back to Cliff Harris. I talk to him a lot, you see, because he's my publisher and friend. He's making Production Line at the moment, which is an isometric car factory simulator, I guess. He might describe it better than that. But one of the things he's doing is on his forum putting up polls for what people want to see next in the game. And what he thought they might want is not what they choose. Okay. So, you know, he said they never choose graphics or performance as things to improve. They always want a new car or some kind of new feature. So the interesting thing is, as developers, it's very easy for us to say, oh, yeah, we need to do this, we need to do that, and this is what customers want. And the reality may be very, very different, in fact. And you only really find that out once you start testing it on people, which is why they say test early and test often.
Oh, definitely. A really good example of this, and my voice can hold up, I'm really sorry about that, is from Skyshine's Bedlam, which was another game that had immense critical response. The fans, like the people they showed it to, loved that game. But when they put that out into the mainstream market, it bombed really bad for them. And again, like you can say that among my 10 my family and, you know, the 30 people who visit my forum, that this is the best damn game of all time. But when you start putting this out into the mainstream market, and if people are saying, well, I don't like so and so, you really need to start looking at that as, do I need to change this? And as you just said very well, Jake, this is why you need to test early and often with your titles.
Yeah, and one of the things I did when I made Regency Solitaire was I went on the Big Fish forums and I read all the feedback for the previous game I made, but also other similar games. I read the feedback from the customers and, you know, they said, I love this feature, or I don't like this feature, and so on. And I collated all of that into a sort of a big chart. And I made sure that I didn't put the crappy things in and I only put the good things in my game. And then I came up with some new innovations to make it stand out. And I think, you know, the results speak for themselves. But that was a case of definitely listening to the customers. You still have to filter it through a kind of, does the customer really know what their problem is here? Because sometimes when you dig in a bit further, there's a deeper issue, which somebody recently, I think it was Tyler from Darkest Dungeon, he said, you dig into it like a rotten apple when you discover the problem is something else that you need to fix. But that's what you should do as a developer is listen, but not do exactly what they say. Try to interpret.
Yeah. You got to be careful that like you're not having your audience control your
game.
Designed
by committee, essentially.
Exactly. Because then, like, you have to balance that out between it being your game and it being this jumble mess that everybody. I put everything in this game that everybody wanted, and now the game is really bad because nobody wants everything, and most people don't even know what they want.
Big time. And you've got to be the vision holder for your game, and you know, compare any suggestions against that core vision, and either throw them out or keep them. So even for Shadowhand, we've got a lot of ideas that we could put into another game, but we're not putting in this because it doesn't match the sort of core design pillars that we're going for.
Yeah, and that goes back to what I was just saying before my voice decided to die on me a few minutes ago, with the idea of this core foundation. What is your game in a nutshell? And all choices and elements in your game have to either be a part of that or grow from it. Or then you start running to that issue where you have stuff in your game that has no relation to actually playing your game with your core gameplay loop. And one thing that Arkham Games has done lately is they know they try to hammer their game down to this core foundation. Everything is related to, and then any secondary ideas would be saved for DLC or expansion if the first idea succeeds. Because it doesn't make sense, again, to put 5 years worth of content in a game that people may, doesn't come back to sell. It's easier to say, let's work on this game for a year or two, put everything we want that works, and then if people want more, well, we got all the stuff that, you know, is just waiting in the wings that we can add in if there is interest.
Yeah, and I think it's a smart way to construct games. Actually, the thing with Shadowhand is because it's a linear game, mm-hmm. a story game where you play through a bunch of levels, that has now I'm losing my voice. That has made it hard to cut things out, whereas another type of design is you make a small core mm-hmm. and you keep expanding that until your money runs out and you have to ship it. And then, of course, you can come back and add more to it later. So for my next game, I might try to construct it around, like, imagine you had a map of a world. Mm-hmm. You could start with some core areas, make sure that worked. And if you still mm-hmm. had the budget and people were into it, you could expand that. Whereas our game, because it's linear based, is very tricky for us to mm-hmm. remove things. So that's worth indies bearing in mind when they come up with their initial design. Is this the kind of game they can safely bail out of and ship at any point?
Yeah. And again, you just, as we've said multiple times, you never can truly estimate or narrow down just how long it'll take to make a game. And I am sure for yourself and for any developers listening to this, they can certainly attest to never having or never being able to say, I will design this game in exactly 1 year, 6 months, 2 days, and 5 hours from now, and I will release it at this exact point, and everything will be working fine. No one, I think, in the history of the game industry has ever said those exact words.
No. One interesting thing I had to do more than once was release in time for a seasonal event, mm-hmm. such as Christmas or Easter, because I've made two Easter games, two Christmas games, and one Halloween game. And when those, you know, often I would start those games too late anyway, and I would be staying up all night working crazy hours attempting to get it ready in time because – you know, you can't move those seasonal events. You have to get the game ready at least a month plus in advance to send to the distributors so that they can package it on their platforms and launch it in good time of the event. Like, you don't want to launch a Christmas game on Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. You want to launch it early in December when people are feeling festive, you know? Mm-hmm. But that means you have to have the thing finished in October or something, right? So I've had to do that and push certain things out on time. And it was quite good as a thing which forced me to finish the game, and I never got everything I wanted to get done in those games. I made a list of improvements mm-hmm. and then they made it into the next game, and some improvements I've got noted I still didn't put in years. You know,
and I want to go back to what you said a few minutes ago, Jake, just to elaborate on one point I thought was really well about how you took the impressions and reviews from your previous game and from games similar to it and kind of constructed this game plan about what people liked, what people didn't like, and then how to improve things further. Because that really reminds me of, I was just talking to a friend of mine about Blizzard the other night, and how Blizzard is certainly masters of that. They are one of the most analytical companies around, and they are just experts at elevating design by taking that laser focus to a game, saying, okay, here's what the fans like, here's what they didn't like, here's what we liked, here's what we thought can be improved. Now let's make a game, or let's make the best possible version of this game and give it our own, you know, seal of approval, in a manner of speaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've done some really great talks on the GDC Vault. Mm-hmm. You can see, I think they're free. You know, you can watch talks about Hearthstone and stuff, and they're really good, interesting to see how much detail they went into. And again, they threw away a lot of designs to get to the final product.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, hell, we could, if it wasn't, it's actually starting to snow here. We're trapped in here. We could talk for the next 5-6 hours. Like, I'm not going anywhere. But I'm sure you will eventually have to have food. The hunger bar will eventually run out.
That's right.
But like with Blizzard again, like I was talking about this. Blizzard is not a company of innovation. They don't make things 100% brand new, but they are a company of refinement. They can look at a game and figure out exactly over time what are the best parts of this, and then how can we make the best parts better and take out the worst parts. And there is certainly a lot of master-level game development that goes on at Blizzard because of that.
Yeah, big time. And I think that's what I did with my match three games. They got better and better each time. And, you know, I did that with Regency Solitaire. And Shadowhand, because this is my first attempt at a full-scale commercial RPG, I am actually, you know, I've had to go through a huge amount of research of other games. I'm not just doing it like off the top of my head. I look at other games, I make notes, I read in documents, I discuss it with designers, so that I'm kind of throwing out ideas as I progress. And I hope that what comes out is great. But, you know, I've no doubt that in the future, I will look back upon it and think, oh, I should have done this different or that different. And if I make a sequel, you know, I will change this element and that element. Things which almost are too late to change in the design now, you know, but you often don't know until you've shipped it and until enough people have played it.
Yeah. All right. I'm checking our time. We have gone over the hour. I'm sure you have to get going in a few minutes. I guess for me, I have one final question. This could be a very big one or a very small one, depending upon your answer. But for you, James, do you have any final questions or anything you would like to ask Jake about regarding being an indie developer?
I guess I'm going to ask a question that that will the question that I would have would lead into more a longer topic. So my question would be, when can we have you on next?
Well, you know, I've got to keep working on Shadowhand. So I need to focus on that. I don't mind coming on the stream, as I said before, and to talk about that. If you want to go into a more in-depth discussion about the business of indie, in fact, maybe even do a post-mortem of Shadowhand, I'd be happy to do that later in the, later in the year. And I can tell you what went right and what went wrong and so on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That is a discussion that we got to have. I cannot wait for that one.
And as going back to one other point that I was just thinking about regarding, as you were saying about the dangers of design by committee, I mean, there is a whole podcast, probably a podcast and a half, about that kind of decision-making when it comes to playtesting your game. And it reminded me of a really good example I wanted to bring up quickly. When I spoke with Charles from Jara, I'm sorry if I just mispronounced your pseudonym, Jara Technologies, who did Conceal the Tent, he talked about how open he was to ideas from the community, but there were a few things he would not bend on. He said, if we change this, this will not be Conceal the Tent anymore. This will be another game. And that, I think, goes back to what we were saying regarding your core gameplay loop. You need to put your foot down with just exactly what you want your game to be, but it's still important to be receptive and open to other ideas.
Yeah, and I think sometimes the ideas that come through aren't they're not necessarily about the core game. They're sort of about things that in the UI or little things that would make it easier for people to progress or find some information out. Stuff like that. So I think they're also worth listening to as well, because they're sort of nice cosmetic features which you can add to the game. And so with Shadowhand, I've got a large list of sort of polish items that I could do before I launch, but I sort of want to launch. Well, I need to launch quickly and not spend another month polishing. But when I've launched, I can see which ones of those people say, oh, can you do this and can you do that? And then only do those. So it's more efficient than doing all sort of 200 of them or whatever. I might only need to do 20 or something. Yeah.
And those quality of life features can go a long way, especially if there are, as you just said, if three people say, can you do so-and-so, that's not, you know, it's good, but it's not a big deal. If, you know, 500 people on your forum say, why can't we have this, this, and this? Well, that kind of gives you a pretty good idea of what you should focus on next.
Yeah, and have you heard of Tom Francis, the developer of Gunpoint? Yes. So he came up with I saw one of his talks, and he had a grid, sort of four squares. And I think along one axis was how cool the feature was, and the other axis was how hard it is to make, right? So, and this is what I do with all the features and ideas I come up with. I analyze, oh, that's going to take ages to make, it's really hard, and it's not even that cool. Why would I bother, right? You know, or something else is just, I spent a few hours last night adding stuff that was really quick fire things, half an hour here, 20 minutes there, but they were all cool and they were very quick to add. And you feel good as a developer when you do that, because you're making real progress that's obvious to players. And you know, and it didn't didn't take long. So that may seem obvious, but I think a lot of people forget that and they go off down, you know, and the wrong alley for a long time making this feature that really no one cares about. Yeah.
It's like saying that my platformer is so great, let's add in a brand new stealth system to it. I'm sure people will love stealth in my game. And then, let's add in a first person segment and let's just keep doing this and let's change our engine a few times. And then suddenly you have that 10-year Duke Nukem Forever train wreck right there.
And you're also left with a game that no longer resembles what the original vision was either. So. Mm-hmm.
All right. Mm-hmm. Here is my final question. Again, I think we could just easily just sit here and talk for who knows how many more hours. Again, James and I, we are trapped in our respective homes right now. We're not going anywhere for the next few hours. But here's my last question I want to ask you, Jagan. I think this one's going to be very important for developers and enthusiasts listening. Again, you've been in this industry in terms of, from a business point of view, for over 12 years now. And again, this is a question that I love to ask developers who have been doing this for a long time. For someone brand new listening to this cast right now, someone who's either in college or high school, or maybe they have just started making their first actual game, do you have any words of wisdom, like, you know, hindsight, you know, 2020 and all that, that you can offer to someone brand new as something to avoid as they're being like the first time experience?
Okay, sure. Avoid making games. I'll build up from there. They should definitely watch my GDC talk, the one that's on YouTube. We'll get a link put in the bottom of your article there. But basically, you know, there's a lot of pain ahead, right? If you decide to make games for a living, and it may not work out well. And like, if you're not 100% sure that's what you want to do, if you haven't got this burning desire to do that, maybe don't do it, right? Because you're going to have to, it's like running a marathon, you know, and trying to survive. But if you want to sort of make games, as I said earlier, as a hobby in your spare time, whilst you've got a part-time job or full-time job, or when you're still living with your parents, that's a really great time to really build up those skills, get good at it, release free games. And you'll soon know whether you've got sort of what it takes and whether you're interested enough in and passionate enough to keep that going. And then you can try making those small games, commercial games, seeing how those go and building up from there. So, yeah, so my don't jump into it until you're sure that's what you want to do. And when you do, make sure you've got some kind of funding or what we call runway. So you know how you can survive for X months. Now, if you say I've got funding, I'm going to make a 6-month game, you need to get a runway for 12 months because that 6 months is going to run out and you'll still be working on your game. And when you ship it, you've still got to sort of wait a bit longer for the money to come in from the distributors or publishers. You know, you might ship it in January and not get any money till March or whatever. So all of that must be factored in. And I would say also, don't spend much money on your first game. That's another thing. Don't spend much money on stuff. Just get used to it. And when you've gained skills, that's when you can start to invest money in art, sound, audio, you know, other team members and so on. Another big mistake is people set up a team, you know, oh, there's 10 of us. We're all going to make mobile games. And they spend a year, 10 people making a mobile game. That's now a 10 person year mobile game. And how much money do you think that's got to make to make, it's got to make them $1 million or something to pay everyone. Back with all the expenses and overheads of an office. So keep things small and tight and focused and try to run it like a business. I guess that's the other thing is I ran a business for 9 years before making games. And so I knew how to do my accounts and I had to watch my expenses and how to do cash flow and project ahead. All that kind of stuff is very important if you want to run a business. And you either you've got to figure it out or get someone else on the team who can do that for you. I mean, I could go on, but there's a lot of stuff on my video about things that kind of worked for me and mistakes that I made.
Yeah, man, I think you made some really good points there, Jake, especially about not going all in on something that's completely untested or something that you've never done before. Again, I think that's kind of what was one of the big things that happened with Gaslamp and Clockwork Empires. They went from a 2D isometric game of a roguelike to a 3D city builder slash dwarf fortress title. And those two games, there's nothing in between there. There's nothing that they could have learned from Dreadmoor that they could put into Clockwork Empires. And so they're basically essentially going back to zero again and trying to figure things out while they're trying to build the stuff they need to make the game in the first place. And
the market changed a lot between their first game and their next game. You know, it could be said of a lot of indies that made it big back in the day that if they release now, they might disappear without a trace because the market's very different.
Definitely. I mean, that's another 30-minute conversation right there easily. The other point I just want to quickly expand on that you also said was about not shortchanging your budget. Because this is something that I've seen some developers from Kickstarter who have sadly gone this route of saying, well, our game, we need $200,000 to make this game, but let's put our Kickstarter at $150,000 and, you know, and we'll work extra hard and try to get it done like that. You never want to shortchange your budget like that. Because as you said, 9 times, or I think at this point, 10 times out of 10, you are not going to finish your game under time. If you say your game takes 1 year, you're not going to magically get it done in 5 months. I think that's another thing that's never going to happen.
Yep, I agree. Yeah, and you do see that a lot. I sometimes see very tiny Kickstarters, and I think, unless your overheads are zero, you know, that's just not going to happen. You know, I see Kickstarters that are like 1 month of overhead for me, and I'm just like, how can they expect to even finish this game?
Yeah.
So,
and again, it goes back to what we were saying earlier in this cast about how there are people who, you know, they go for the big gamble. They think, oh, I'm going to put my Kickstarter earlier or shortchange it, and then we're going to get a publisher, and then they're going to love this game. They're going to give us, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we'll build this amazing one-of-a-kind game that we have no hope of making in the first place if we didn't get this funding that way. And,
you know, it's very alluring to have that big hit. So people want to have that big hit, and they hear the stories, and they think they've got to make the big game to make the big hit. And it's exciting, and they feel, you know, this is their dream game. But my sort of final parting advice would be to play it safe.
Yeah.
That's what I've done. I've played it safe, and people might look at me and say, well, you haven't had a hit game, have you? But I haven't really been trying. I've just been trying to keep going along and surviving, and I'm still here. 12 years later, I'm still here. Yeah. I'm still making games. I work at home. I support my family. Yeah. I love what I do. Yes. So it's worked for me, and that's because I've tried to build a sustainable business, not tried to go all out. I'm hoping Shadowhand will be a medium or higher hit, but if it isn't, I'll find a way to survive and keep going because I haven't staked everything on this. So, you know, we still have a house with a mortgage and we're, you know, stuff like that. So we got to play it safe. That's my advice. Don't be suckered in by the sort of rock stars of indiedom. Build your skills up and slow and steady. It's not as glamorous or exciting, but that's how you survive the long term.
And I'm glad you really used the term sustainable there, Jay, because I think here are my final thoughts on it. One, that again goes back to that avoiding that allure, as you just said, that we've of course seen major names in this industry. We have seen those games that just one day show up, like Five Nights at Freddy's, Stardew Valley, Undertale, etc., that are amazing hits. And it's very easy to think, well, if they can do it, why can't I? But the problem is, and this goes back to what we said at the very beginning of the mysteries of game development, is that for a lot of these studios who have that one big hit, there are very few of them that have survived long term, that have hit a point of being sustainable. And one of the things I always say, and I don't know how controversial this may be, is yes, they may have an amazing game, but where is this studio going to be in 5 years from now, from 10 years from now, heaven forbid, 15, 20 years from now? Are they still going to be making games? Because one of the things I've seen a lot, especially from these one-time big hits, is that a lot of them have either left the industry or they've gone to work for someone else. Like, it's very rare to see someone with a massive hit who's still working in that same company, again, 5 to 10 years from now. And as you said, Jake, that sustainable model, yes, it's not, you know, the most glamorous thing. You're not going to be the rock star. But if it allows you to still do what you love 5, 10 years down the line, then that's better than having one massive hit and then just fizzling out afterwards.
Yeah, big time. And you know what? It's not even easy to be sustainable, right? You know, as going back to James's ratio earlier, the fail rate is very high, you know, so it's not even easy to be sustainable, but it's something that I think is more achievable for more people than going for the big hit. And, you know, maybe when you've built up your resources, skills, contacts, all the sort of hidden stuff as well as the obvious stuff, then you can sort of pull out a few more stops and try to make sort of more noteworthy games that will stand you a better chance.
Yes, exactly. And as we've said, the games that succeed, it looks like they've done like nothing at all. Like, again, like something like Darkest Dungeon, to a lot of people, it just showed up one day on Steam or Early Access and was this big name. But there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes. And for those of you listening to this cast right now, especially if you are a student or a first-timer, this is the part you need to take notes of. There is a lot that goes into making a successful game. And it's not just, you know, one day showing up for a big success. You have to put in the legwork in order for it to succeed. And even then, I think, as we've said, even if you do everything right, there's still a chance you may still fail.
Big time. And you know, you have to be totally aware of that risk and willing to take it. So, I mean, I guess I look at it like this. I could get a regular job making business software and probably make a reasonable income consistently year in, year out, which is what I was doing before I made games. But what there is with it, games is, as providing I can stay sustainable, there's still this chance, and it might be a 1% chance, it might be a 0.1, it might be 10% when I get better, that something could go big and actually, you know, catapult me out of the sort of day job status into something else. And that's kind of exciting and maybe one of the reasons I do it, but I also just love making games. And so, you know, that's also why I do it, right? But I have to be realistic that that percentage is very, very small, okay? So you can't go into it with that as your prime motivator.
Yes. All right. I think that is a great point to end on. And again, it was fantastic talking to you, Jake, on this fine snowy day. I mean, there's still a lot that we can easily go into. And like I said, we could sit here for the next few hours and we probably haven't even scratched the surface. But thank you so much for coming back on. And like I said, when you're free, it will be great to have that live chat and especially a postmortem on Shadowhand in a few months.
Yeah, great to talk to you both today. Thanks for all the questions. Sorry you got all this snow. But yeah, my stomach is rumbling, so I'm going to hit the road. But thanks for having me on again.
No, yes, it's a pleasure.
Not a problem. So for those of you listening to this cast right now, we are going to end things here. By the time you are listening to this up on the site and YouTube channel, hopefully Shadowhand will be close to release. And like we said, hopefully we'll be able to talk to Jake either closer to the release or definitely afterwards. But thank you so much for listening. As always, if you like to support Game Wisdom and what we do, there are multiple options available. If you'd like to be a guest for a future talk or write a guest piece, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted. To support our Patreon campaign and help provide the monthly funding we need, you can find us on Patreon under GW Bites or Game Wisdom. Hitting our goals will allow us to have more content for everyone to enjoy. Be sure to follow us on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer for the latest updates. And, of course, our YouTube channel under Game Wisdom, which is now over 1,500 subscribers, hopefully by the time you are hearing this, and we are continuing to grow. But, again, thank you so much for listening. And, James, it was great having you back on. I'm sure this was a great cast for you as well.
Yes, it was. A very, very enjoyable cast, definitely.
All right. So, again, Jake, thank you so much for coming on, and hopefully we'll be able to do this again real soon.
I hope so, too. All the best, guys.
All right. So, again, for you folks listening, thanks for tuning into this week's Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.